Welcome to The Great Stories. I'm Trev Downey, and each week I'll read and then discuss a truly great short story by one of the iconic authors. Who doesn't enjoy being told a tale? Humans have been telling each other yarns as long as language itself has existed. Stories to entertain, to inspire, to frighten, and to teach. On this podcast, there will be no academic elitism. We will focus only on the story you'll be told, the context in which it appeared, and the author responsible for its creation. The Great Stories, you see, is for everyone. So, gather round, and let's enjoy this episode's tale. Fjord of Killary by Kevin Barry. So I bought an old hotel on the Fjord of Killary. It was set hard by the harbour wall, with Maelri Mountain across the water and disgracefully grey skies above. It rained 287 days of the year, and the locals were given to magnificent mood swings. On the night in question, the rain was particularly violent. It came down like handfuls of nails flung hard and fast by a seriously riled sky god. I was at this point 8 months in the place, and about convinced that it would be the death of me. "It's end of the fucking world stuff out there," I said. The chorus of locals in the hotel's lounge bar, as always, ignored me. I was a fretful blow-in by their mark, and simply not cut out for tough, gnarly West of Ireland living. They were listening instead to John Murphy, our alcoholic funeral director. "I'll bury anything that fucking moves," he said. "Bastards. Suicides. Tinkers," he said. "I couldn't give a fucking monkeys," he said. Maelri is the most depressing mountain you've ever seen, by the way, and its gaunt, looming shape filled almost every view from the Water's Edge Hotel, the lounge bars included. The locals drank mostly Bushmills whiskey and Guinness Stout, and they drank them to great excess. I wiped their slops from the corner with a bar cloth I had come to hate with a passion verging on the insane. I said, "But seriously, that's one motherfucker of a high tide, no?" Barely the toss of a glance I received. The talk had shifted to roads, mileage, general directions. They made a geography of the country by the naming of pubs. "Do you know Madigan's in Maynooth?"
"I do, of course."
"You'd take a left there."
"I have you now."
The hotel had 23 bedrooms and listed westward. Set a can of peas on the floor of just about any bedroom and it would roll slowly in the direction of the gibbering Atlantic. The estate agent had gussied up the history of the place in the brochure. A traditional coaching inn, original beams, visited by Thackeray, heritage bleeding out the wazoo, etc. And I had leaped at it. I was the last of the hopeless romantics. The talk had moved on briefly from roads and directions. "If he's still around when her bandages come off," Bill Knott, the surveyor, said, "he's a braver man than me." "Nice woman," John Murphy agreed, "as long as you don't put your hand in the cage." Behind the bar, the Guinness tap, the Smithwick's tap, the lager taps, the line of optics, the neatly stacked rows of glasses, and a high stool that sat by a wee slit of window that had a view across the water toward Maelri. The iodine tang of kelp hung in the air always, and put me in mind of embalming fluid. Bill Knott looked vaguely from his Bushmills towards the water.
"Highish all right," he said. "But now, what'd we be talking about for Belmullet, would you say? Off a slow road."
The primary interest of these people's lives, it often seemed, was how far one place was from another, and how long it might take to complete the journey, given the state of the roads. Bill had been in haulage as a young man and considered himself an expert.
"I don't know, Bill," I said.
"Would we say 1:20 if you weren't tailbacked out of Newport?"
I said, "I really don't fucking well know, Bill."
"There are those'll say you'd do it in 1 hour. He sipped delicately. "But you'd want to be greased fucking lightning coming up from Westport direction, wouldn't you?"
"We could be swimming it yet, Bill."
I had made, despite it all, a mild success of myself in life. But on turning 40 the previous year, I had sensed exhaustion rising in me like rot.
Before 40, you think that exhaustion is something like a long-lasting hangover. But at 40, you learn all about it. Even your passions exhaust you. I found that to be alone with the work all day was increasingly difficult, and the city had become a jag on my nerves. There was too much young flesh around. The brochure about the hotel appeared in my life like a revelation. I clutched it in my hands for days on end. I grew feverish with the notion of a westward flight. I lay in bed with the brochure, as the throb of the city sounded like a kind of raspy, taunting note, and I moaned as I read, Original Beams, Traditional Coaching Inn, Thackeray, established 1648. The hotel had the promise of an ideal solution. I could distract myself from myself with its day-to-day running, its endless small errands, and perhaps late at night or very early in the morning I could continue at some less intense level with the poetry. All of my friends, every last one of them said, The Shining. But I was thinking, the west of Ireland, the murmurous ocean, the rocky hills hard-founded in a greenish light, the light of a sad dream, the cleansing air, the stoats peeping shyly from gaps in the dry stone walls. Yes, it would all do to make a new man of me. Of course, I hadn't counted on having to listen to my summer staff, a pack of healthily energetic young Belarusians, fucking one another at all angles of the clock. And the ocean turned out to gibber rather than murmur. Gibber, gibber, whoosh. Gibber, gibber, whoosh. Down the far end of the bar, Mick Harty, distributor of bull semen for the vicinity, was molesting his enormously fat wife, Vivian. We're after a meal at the place run by the Dutch faggots, he said. Oysters for a starter. They have me gone fucking bananas. Vivian slapped and roared at him as he stroked her massive haunches. She reddened and chortled as he twisted her around and pulled her vast rear side into his crotch area. Nobody apart from me paid a blind bit of attention to the spectacle. And even as she suffered a pretend butt rape from her cackling husband, she turned to me and informed me precisely what they had paid for the meal at the Dutch couple's restaurant. Two starters, two mains, we shared a dessert, two bottles of wine, two cappuccinos, she said, as Mick grinded slowly behind her, hoarsely yodeling an Alicia Keys ballad. 136 euros even. Not cheap, Queevin. Cappuccino is a breakfast drink, I said. You're not supposed to have it after a meal. I was not well liked out in Killary. I was considered superior. Of course I was fucking superior. I ate at least 5 portions of fruit and veg daily. I had omega-3 from oily fish coming out my ears. I limited myself to 21 units of alcohol a week. I hadn't written 2 consecutive lines of a poem in 8 months. I was becoming versed, instead, in the strange illicit practices of the hill country. Fuckers are washing diesel up there again, John Murphy said. The hooligans. Of course, they'd a father a diesel washer before him, didn't they? Cunts to a man. Cunts, Bill Knott confirmed. Outside, the rain continued to hammer away at our dismal little world, and the sky had shucked the last of its evening grey to take on an intense purplish tone that was ominous, close in, biblical. Sky is weirding up like I don't know fucking what, I said. John Murphy grabbed my elbow as I passed along the bar. He was aggressive always once the third pint was downed, and he said, I suppose you know that possessed fucking she-devil above in the house will put me in the ground. John, I said, I really don't want to hear about it. I mean literally, Queevin, she'll fucking do for me. John, your marriage is your own private business. She's fucking poisoning me. I swear to bleeding fucking Jesus, I can taste it off the fucking tea, Queev. Would you go again, John? I indicated his emptied stout glass. Oh, please, he said. They were all nutjobs. This is what it came down to. This is the thing you learn about habitual country drinkers. They suffer all manner of delusions, paranoia, warped fantasies. It's a most intense world indeed that a hard drinker builds around himself, and it is difficult for him not to assume that everyone else in the place is involved with it. Mick's a man of 60, Vivian Harty said, awed at the persistence of her husband's desires, and he'd still get up on a cracked fucking plate. Just then, a cacophony erupted. From the hillsides, everywhere, came the aggravated howls of dogs. These were amped to an unnatural degree. The talk in the lounge bar stalled for a moment in response, but just as abruptly, it resumed. "The tiramisu," McCarthy said. "You wouldn't know whether to eat it or smear it all over yourself." Nadia, one of my Belarusians, came through from the supper room and sullenly collected some glasses. "The arse on that," John Murphy said. "Please, John," I said. "Two apples and a hanky," he said. I believed all nine of my summer staff to be in varying degrees of sexual contact with one another. I housed them in the dreary, viewless rooms at the back of the hotel where I myself lived during what I will laughably describe as high season, the innocence, and my sleepless nights were filled with the sound of their rotating passions. "Thank you, Nadia," I said. She scowled at me as she placed the glasses in the dishwasher. I was never allowed to forget that I was paying minimum wage. The dogs had stopped. The rain continued. It was by now a hysterical downpour, with great sheets of water steaming down from Whale Ree, and the harbour roared in the fattening light. Visibility was reduced to 14 feet. This all signalled that the West of Ireland holiday season had begun. "He was thrown down," John Murphy said, speaking of a man he had lately buried. "He went into himself. He didn't talk for a year and a half, and then he choked on a sausage. You'd visit and he'd say nothing to you, but he'd know you were there. The little eyes would follow you around the room." "Age was he when he went, John?"
42.
"Youngish. Ara, he was better off out of it." My first weeks out at the water's edge, I had kept a surreptitious notebook under the bar. The likes of "thrown down" would get a delighted entry. I would guess at the likely etymology from "thrown down," as in laid low. But I had quickly had my fill of these maudlin bastards. This, by the way, was the Monday of the May Bank holiday weekend. Killary was en fête. Local opinion, cheerfully, was that it had been among the wettest bank holidays ever witnessed. The few deluded hillwalkers and cyclists who had shown up had departed early in wordless outrage, and in the library room at the water's edge there was just a pair of elderly couples still enjoying the open fire. I left the bar and took a pass through the library to smile at them, to throw on a few sods of turf, and to make sure they hadn't died on the premises. They stared into the flames. "That's some evening," I tried, but there was no response. Both couples held hands and appeared to be significantly tranquilized. Coming through the lobby again, I looked out through the doors and saw a pair of minks creep over the harbour wall. They crossed the road in perfect tandem and headed for the rising fields beyond the hotel. I went back into the bar. I found that I had an odd nausea developing. "They can cut out that particular gland," Bill Knott said, "but if the wound goes septic after..." He shook his head hopelessly. "That," he said, "is when the fun and games start." Mine was one of four licensed premises in a scattered district of 300 odd souls. This is a brutal scarcity by Irish ratios, so there was enough trade to keep us all tunnelling toward oblivion. The bar was another of the elements that had sold the place to me. It was pleasant, certainly, with an old-fashioned mahogany finish, zinc-topped low tables, and some prints of photo finishes from fabled race meetings at Ballybrit. I always tended bar in the evenings. I had had a deranged notion that this would establish me as a kind of charming innkeeper figure. This was despite the fact that not one, but two ex-girlfriends, both of them admittedly sharp-tongued academics, had described my manner as funereal. The barside babble continued unchecked. Bill Knott was now reckoning the distance to Derry if you were to go via Enniskillen. Vivian Harty was telling John Murphy that that wasn't tuppence worth of a coat his wife had on the Tuesday gone, that he was looking after her all the same, and that no woman deserved it more, given what she'd been through with the botched hysterectomy. Mick Harty talked of the cross-border trade in stallions and looked faintly murderous. "Our horses the fuckers are after now," he said. Nadia, meantime, was singing weird Belarusian pop beneath her breath as she got up on the footstool to polish the optics. A seep of vomit rose in my gullet. I was soul sick. I was failing spectacularly at this whole mine host lark. I quietly leaned on the bar by the till. I looked out the small window. Watery it was.
"Seriously, lads, we haven't seen a tide that high, surely," I said. "Have we?"
It was lapping by now at the top of the harbour wall. The estate agent had assured me that the place never flooded. I'd looked the slithery old fuck in the eye and believed him. I had suspected, I had hoped,
that the life I found out here would eventually do something for my work. Something would gestate in me. I'd be able to move away from all that obtuse, arrhythmic stuff about the sex heat of cities that had made me mildly famous in provincial English departments. My poetry was known of, but not a difficulty for the Killary locals. There had never been a shortage of poets out there. Every last crooked rock of the place had at some point seated the bony arse of some hypochondriacal epiphany seeker. Some fucker who'd forever be giving out about his lungs.
You'd do jail time for that, John Murphy said.
He was eyeing once more the rear quarters of Nadia as she headed for the kitchen. John, I've warned you about this, I said.
I'm only saying, he said.
He sullenly turned back to his stout. The people of this part of North Galway are oversexed. That is my belief. I had found a level of ribaldry that bordered on the paganistic. It goes back, of course. They lick it up off the crooked rocks. Thackeray, indeed, remarked on the corsetless dress of rural Irish women and the fact that they kissed perfect strangers in greeting, their vast bosoms swinging. It's not, John Murphy said, like I'm going to take a lep at the little bitch. My leppin' days are long fucking over. If I sold the place for even 3/4 of what I paid for it, I could buy half of Cambodia and do a Colonel fucking Kurtz on it. Lovely, cold-hearted Nadia came running from the kitchen. She was as white as the fallen dead.
Is Otter, she cried.
What?
Is Otter in kitchen, she cried.
He was eating soup when I got there. Carrot and coriander from a 10-gallon pot. Normally they are terribly skittish, otters, but this fellow was languorous as a surfer. Nervously I shooed him toward the back door. He took his own sweet time about heading there. Once outside, he aimed not for the tide-line rocks where the otters all lived, but for the higher ground, south. I looked out toward the harbour. The harbour wall was disappearing beneath spilling sheets of water. I came back into the lounge.
A fucking otter is right, I said.
They looked at me, the locals, in quiet disgust, as if I could expect no less than otters in the kitchen, the way I was after letting things go. I pointed to the harbour.
Will it flood?
I asked, and there was a quake in my tone.
You'd make good time coming out of Sligo normally, Bill Knott said, unless you had a Thursday on your hands, but of course them fuckers have any amount of road under them since McSharry was minister.
I said, will it flood, Bill? Will it flood? Are you even listening to me?
A grey silence swelled briefly.
Hasn't in 16 years, he said.
Won't now.
I spent all my waking hours keeping the water's edge on the go. I was short-breathed, tense, out of whack. I was at roughly the midpoint of what for poets would be termed a long silence. 5 years had passed since my last collection. Any time I sat down to page or screen, I felt as if I might weep, and I didn't always resist the temptation. Mountain bleakness, the lapidary rhythms of the water, the vast schizophrenic skies. These weren't inspiring poetry in me. They were inspiring hopeless lust and negative thought patterns. Again and again the truth was confronting me. I was a born townie, and I had made a dreadful mistake in coming here. I set down a fresh Bushmills for Bill Knott.
This place your crowd are from, he said.
Belarus.
Yes, Bill.
What way'd they be for road out there?
When you think, Vivian Harty said, of what this country went through for the sake of Europe, when we went on our hands and fucking knees before Brussels to be given the lick of a fucking butter voucher, and as soon as we have ourselves even halfway right, these bastards from the back end of nowhere decide they can move in wherever they like and take our fucking jobs.
On the Killary hillsides, the dogs howled again in fright night sequence, one curdling scream giving way to another. They were even louder now than before.
Mother of Jesus, John Murphy said.
The dogs were so loud now as to be unignorable. We all went to the windows. The roadway between the hotel and harbour wall had in recent moments disappeared. The last of the evening light was an unreal throb of Kermit green. The dogs howled. The rain continued.
The roads, Bill Knott said, at last impressed, will be impassable.
Mick Harty's hands slipped down over the backs of Vivian's thighs. The rain came in great unstoppable drifts on a high westerly from the Atlantic.
That ain't quitting any time soon, I said, stating the blindingly obvious.
Water's up to the second step,
Vivian Harty noted. Four old stone steps led up to the inn's front porch.
And rising, Mick Harty said.
I haven't seen rain the likes of that, John Murphy said, since Castlebar, the March of 73.
What did we be talking about for Castlebar? Bill Knott said.
45 minutes on a light road? We moved back from the windows. Our movement had become curiously choreographed. Quiet calls were made on mobiles. We spoke now in whispers. All along the fjord, word quickly had it, the waters had risen and had breached the harbour walls. The emergency services had been alerted. There was talk, a little late for it, of sandbagging. We were joined in the lounge bar by 6 of the 9 Belarusians. The other 3 had gone to the Cineplex in Westport, fate having put on a Dan Brown adaptation, and by the 2 elderly couples who had managed not to die off in the library. I said, a round of drinks on the house, folks. We may be out here for some time. Applause greeted this. I felt suddenly that I was growing into the mine host role. There was a conviviality in the bar, the type that is said to come always with a threatened disaster. Great howls of wind echoed down the Duloch Valley, and they were answered in volleyed sequence by the howls of the Killery dogs. 4 of the 6 Belarusians wore love bites on their necks as they sipped at their complimentary bottled Heinekens. They were, apparently, feasting delightedly on one another in my back rooms. The elderlies introduced themselves. We met Alan and Nora Fettle from Limerick and Jimmy and Janie McAllister from Limavady. They were the least scared among us, the least awed. "Yon wind's changing," Jimmy Mack said. "Yon wind's shifting easterly, so 'tis."
I wouldn't like the sounds of that, John Murphy said. Not much good will ever come out of a swapping wind.
You'd hear that said.
It was said also in Killery that an easterly wind unseated the mind. I shot a glance outside, and on a low branch of the may tree hanging over the water, a black-backed gull had apparently killed its mate and was starting to eat it. This didn't seem like news that anybody wanted to hear, so I kept it to myself. Alexei, the conspicuously wall-eyed Belarusian, had gone to survey the scene from an upstairs window, and he returned to report that the car park beside the hotel was flooded completely.
Insurance will cover any damage, Bill Knott soothed. It's going to be one of those fucking news clips, John Murphy said. Some fucking ape sailing down the street on a tea tray.
Jesus Christ, what's that gull doing? Nora Fettle said.
It was an inopportune moment to draw attention to the gull's situation. The blackback had just at that instant managed to prise its partner's head off and was flailing it about. Janie McAllister passed out cold on the floor. There was no getting away from the fact that we were being sucked into the deeps of an emergency. I was getting happy notions. I was thinking, the place gets wiped out, I claim the insurance and it's Cambodia, here I come. Nora Fettle and Vivian Harty tended to Janie McAllister. She was frothing a little and moaning softly. They called for brandy. Bill Knott signalled for a fresh Bushmills. John Murphy for a pint of stout. We all looked out the windows. The water had passed the 4th step and was sweeping over the porch. We were on some vague level aware that the house lights still burned on the far side of the harbour, along the mountainside of Muil Rhee. Then, at once, the lights over there cut out.
Good night, Irene, Bill Knott said.
The worst of the news was that the emergency appeared to be localised. The fjord of Killery was flooding when no other place was flooding. The rest of the country was going about its humdrum Monday night business, watching football matches or Dan Brown adaptations, putting out the bins or putting up with their marriages, while the people of our vicinity prepared for watery graves. I felt, finally, as if I'd been accepted, and I felt that the worst possible course would be to close the bar. There was a kind of hilarity to the proceedings still, and this would not be maintained if I stopped serving booze. The pace of the drinking, if anything, quickened now that the waters were rising. You'd never know when you were going to lift your last.
Would we want to be making south? Mick Harty wondered. Vivian rubbed at his wrist so tenderly that I found myself welling up.
Hush, she said. Hush it, babes.
If we went up past Loch Fee and swung around the far side of her, Bill Knott said, we'd nearly make it to the N59.
The Belarusians carted boxloads of old curtains down from the attic to use as sops against the doorways, but the moment the last boxload reached the bottom of the stairs, the doors popped,
and the waters entered. I moved everybody upstairs. There was a function room up there that I used for the occasional wedding. It had a fully stocked bar and operational disco lights. We weren't a moment too soon. As I trailed up the stairs, keeping to the rear of all my locals and Belarusians, I cast an eye back over my shoulder. It had the look of death's dateless night out there. "Hop, people," I cried. "Hop, for Jesus' sake." The function room was used less often than it should have been. The locals got married in Alghero if they had the price of it at all. More calls were made on mobiles. We were promised that the emergency services were being moved out. I turned off the harsh strip lighting overhead and switched to the mood lighting, which moved in lovely dreamy disco swirls. Even yet, the rain hammered down on my old hotel at Killary. I opened the bar, and the locals weren't shy about stepping up to it. We drank. We whispered. We laughed like cats. Bill Knott reckoned the distance to Clare Island oversea, if it should come to it. Of course, it would not be the first time, he said, that the likes of us would be sent hopping for the small boats. Vivian Harty whispered to Janie McAllister. Janie's colour was returning with frequent nips of my brandy. Vivian swirled it in the glass and fed it to the old lady. Her tiny grey head she cradled on a vast lap. "There's little fear of you now, my sweet," she said. Thackeray, on visiting the backwoods of Ireland, bemoaned the choking peat smoke and the obstreperous cider and the diet of raw ducks, raw peas, and also a particular inn. No pen can describe that establishment, as no English imagination could have conceived it. John Murphy told us loudly that he loved his wife. "She still excites me," he said. "It's been 28 years and I still get a horn on me when I see that bitch climb a stairs." I went to the landing outside the function room. I looked down the road. It was a waterway. The hotel's porch had disappeared and dozens of cormorants were approaching in formation across the water. It was like the attack on Dresden. I rushed back into the function room just as the cormorants landed on the tarpaulin of the kitchen roof out back, and a weeping Mick Harty was confessing to Vivian an affair of 15 years standing with her sister. "All the old filth starts to come out," Alan Fettle said. Vivian approached her husband and embraced him, and planted a light kiss on his neck as they held each other against the darkness. Then she bit him on the neck. Blood came in great angry spurts. I vomited briefly and decided to put on some music. I looked out the landing window as I dashed across the corridor to get some CDs from my room. This was a bad move. 7 sheep in a rowing boat were being bobbed about on the vicious waters of Killary. The sheep appeared strangely calm. I picked lots of old familiars, old favourites. ABBA, The Pretenders, Bryan Adams. I pelted back to the function room. "We're here," I cried. "We might as well have a disco." Oh, and we danced the night away out on the fjord of Killary. We danced to Chiquitita, slowly and sensuously. We danced in great wet-eyed nostalgia to Brass in Pocket, and we had all the old steps still, as if 1979 were only yesterday. We punched the air madly to Summer of 69. I went out to the landing to find the 6 Belarusians sitting on the top step of the stairs. The waters of Killary were halfway up the stairs. Footstools sailed by in the lobby below, toilet rolls, placemats, phone books. But what could I do? I returned to the function room and served out pints hand over fist. All mobile signals were down. There appeared on the horizon no saviours in high-vis clothing. The waters were rising yet. And the view was suddenly clear to me. The world opened out to its grim beyonds, and I realised that at 40 one must learn the rigours of acceptance. Capitalise it. Acceptance. I needed to accept what was put before me. Be it a watery grave in Ireland's only natural fjord, or a return to the city and its greyer intensities, or a wordless exile in some steaming Cambodian swamp hole, or poems, or no poems, or children, or not, lovers, or not, illness, or otherwise, success, or its absence. I would accept all that was put in my way, from here on through, until I breathed my last. Electrified, I searched for a notebook. Bill Knott danced. John Murphy danced. The McAllisters and the Fettles waltzed. The Belarusians dry-humped one another in the function room's darker corners. The Harties were in deep emotional conversation in a banquet booth. Mick held to his bleeding neck a wad of napkins. I myself took to the floor, swiveling slowly on my feet, and I closed my eyes against the swirling disco lights. The pink backs of my lids became twin screens for flashing apparitions of my childhood pets.
"Are ye enjoying yourselves, lads?" I cried.
"Oh, heel up the cart there now.
What did we be talking about for Loch Ray, would you say?"
"Didn't I come back from that place, one lung half the size of the other?"
"Sure, that's England for you."
I ran out to the landing for a spot check on the flooding situation, and was met there by Alexei, the walled-eyed Belarusian. He indicated with a happy jerk of his thumb the water level on the stairs. It had dropped a couple of steps. I patted his back and winked just the once and returned to the disco. 1648 was a year shy of Cromwell's landing in Ireland, and already the inn at Killary Fjord was in business. It would see out this disaster too. Now random phrases and images came at me. The sudden quick-fire assaults that signal a new idea. And I knew that they would come in sequence soon enough. Their predestined rhythms would assert. I felt a new, quiet ecstasy take hold. The gloom of youth had at last lifted.
And that was Fjord of Killary by Kevin Barry. And I'm joined by Neil Poole to discuss that story. Neil, we have had a little chance to have a chat before the mics went live here, sort of atypically little free chat before we actually started recording. And I think both of us are pretty much of a mind on this in terms of, you know, I say it all the time, but this may well be my favorite one to date. And it's just so relatable for lads who are of the vintage that I am. I'm not going to include you in it, but you might be worrying the bracket at this stage, you know, in terms of the way that this guy thinks, the way that he speaks, the way he articulates himself, the concept of the tortured artist. It's just eminently relatable story.
Yeah, definitely. I was thinking as well. I was thinking exactly the same thing. This could be the best story that we've done, but I feel like we might have said that about 25 times. Yeah. But that's just down to you, Trev, and the quality of story that you're picking out for us. So that was really good. And yes, it's worryingly relatable. I would say, you know, when you read a story or you hear a story and then the main character is saying lots of things that you think, I'd say that. Or he's thinking lots of things and you'd think, I'd say that. And the traps he falls into in this, which we'll talk about in terms of way things not turning out, how you would expect them to turn out. All of that really rings true. And I could imagine happening to both of us, Trev, if we went and bought a hotel called the Water's Edge on the west coast of Ireland. It feels something very much like me and you might do on a whim.
It really does. I think that's why it's so relatable. And look, I'll be honest with you. We do say this a lot. I do say this a lot about how it's my favorite story. But, you know, it's because, yeah, we're lucky we keep coming across these really good stories to do and to bring to folks. And this one will be less, I suppose, the conversation about it will be less sort of maybe, not less structured, but less sort of focused on theme and technique and things like that. Because this is more of a visceral experience for me as a reader. And that's why I wanted to bring that in straight away. And look, Jimmy Joyce, who we've covered at least twice in the series so far, that man speaks to my soul as an Irish man. There's just no two ways about it. He just does. It just communicates with me, Joyce's writing, in a way that I can't even fully understand still. And because he speaks in an idiom that's ancient and not necessarily mine, and yet so mine. But Barry is, I think, maybe 5 years older than me, maybe sort of early 50s kind of age. And as a result of that, he's so relatable for that reason. He's basically my generation. He's a guy who talks and speaks and thinks in a way that I'm obviously going to find very, very easy to understand and relate to. But you know what I thought, Neil, not making it personal, but actually spreading the love a bit here, you would be my favorite laconic man, you know? You know, for lads who've been pals going back a while now, I love chatting to you because I always feel happier after talking to you because we have a laugh about whatever we're talking about. And yet you can come out with a line that just makes me think, where the hell did that bleakness come from? So I think you must really get Queeveen, obviously Kevin Barry, Queeveen is the Irish. You must really get Queeveen too.
Absolutely. And we discussed this story and another story, and I was absolutely sold on the first paragraph of this story. Because for anyone who actually reads it and has a look, you'll see it in the New Yorker magazine, and there's this very sort of like pastel artistic picture of, you know, the fjord. And before you read a word of it, it gives you an impression that it's going to be quite a sort of serious story. And then when you actually read it, it just goes bang, and it just hits you straight away. This fella moaning, immediately inverting exactly what you think it's going to happen. You think it's going to be about this beautiful fjord, and it's going to be all of this, you know, talked about it in romantic landscapes and everything. But he absolutely hates it. And from line one, he hates scenery. He hates the setting. He hates the weather. He hates the hotel. He hates all of the people. He hates all of the people in the hotel. Do you know what actually reminded me of a little bit? He's almost like Basil Fawlty. It's like Fawlty Towers. You know, he's just ended up. He runs this hotel and he hates the people who work in the hotel and he hates all of the guests and he just hates everything to do with it. And the whole thing just brings him up into this ball of anger. So when this story starts, and I've listened to you reading it like four times now, it's just great. It sounds like this takes place in a pub or, you know, like a hotel, but it actually, not only does it take place in a pub or a hotel, but it actually feels a little bit like he could be in another pub on another day telling you this story about what happened when he used to own the Water's Edge. It's literary, but it's really colloquial. I think it's a really realistic voice. You very much feel like you're being talked to and part of this sort of conversation. It's absolutely brilliant.
You know, the story itself, I think, was inspired by a cycling trip that Barry did go on the west of Ireland, and he called into a pub, which would be the equivalent of the setting for our short story here. And he was listening to the locals talking and being obsessed with weather and distance, specifically the distance from place to place. So much of this story, and at the same time, in real life, he's sheltering from a storm that's happening outside. So he said that the story kind of came to him in a sort of a massive flood of inspiration from that setting that he's in. So it's interesting that it comes from a situation that was so true to life. And of course, Queeveen, Kevin, the author, the autobiographical input of that is central. You can't escape it. Barry, it was around the age of 40 when this story was written. He was a fella who was very like, in many ways, the character of Queeveen here. I think anyone who has any aspirations towards doing anything creative would be able to relate to it, as we've mentioned earlier on, but especially those people who have flirted with the concept of writing in any way, shape or form. And what I love about it is you've talked about how he hates the people and he's got this kind of Basil Fawlty-esque outlook. But what drove him there was this romantic notion about what it would be like. And then, of course, the more prosaic reality of what it is like actually hits him. And what is beautiful about this, Neil, this story, is that even as Queeveen is telling us, our narrator's voice is telling us about how, as you say, bleak and dark the conditions are, and we'll talk about the weather later on and the, you know, fairly obvious pathetic fallacy that's floating through the story, but even as he's complaining about these people and this place and the bloody estate agent the slithery prick of an estate agent, even as he's doing that, you're aware that what drove him there was some sort of romantic impulse. As you said earlier on, a whim, a kind of romantic notion, a big idea, the kind of thing that grips a person like that who is rudderless, listless, sort of seeking anything to kind of anchor them. And at one point, Queeveen's saying, you know, it might be okay if this all went to shit because I could just pack up and go off and be like Colonel Kurtz in Cambodia and, you know, buy half of the country and run my own little compound. And then the other one is, well, you know, later on when he's coming to some service acceptance, well, maybe I could just go back to Dublin. Whatever it is, he's just not happy in his life. And this is the manifestation of it. And it's really interesting as the story goes on that it is this place and these conditions and this weather and this extremity that actually brings him to a moment of epiphany. Would you say it's fair to say, Neil, and we might as well get straight to it, would you say it's fair to say that this story is about that? It's about being 40, being at that stage of your life, and being about what happens at the end, this sort of epiphany, this dawning, this moment of inspiration where he talks about acceptance.
Yeah, and that happens at the end, but through the majority of the story, he's obviously quite miserable. And it's interesting that I think you can empathize very much with the type of thing where he's saying, because he's doing what we all do, where you're never entirely satisfied with your lot at that moment, and you're always waiting for the next thing, you know. And you know, in his case, it was like lives in Dublin, probably. So, right, okay, so he'll be happy if he moves to the west of Ireland. Now he's in the west of Ireland. Okay, well, maybe he'll be happy if he moves to Cambodia. It'll be better there. It's like the idea that you always need to have the dream of the next thing to motivate you and to make you happy. And then what he's found is that every time you get to that point, what was the dream as such, you're not happy. I remember years ago, I haven't read it for a while, but have you ever heard of a book called The Art of Travel?
Yes.
Yeah, so Alan Botton or whatever. I'm not a particular fan or anything, but and I remember reading that book and disagreeing with quite a lot of it. But there's a premise early on about this idea about the idea of traveling is much more attractive than traveling itself. And it's the idea that sort of, you know, you can look at a postcard of like the Caribbean or whatever, and it's amazing. And then when you want to, then when you actually go there, you don't spend ages looking at the same view of what was on the postcard, because it's okay when you're looking at it on a postcard because you only have to look at it for a few seconds. But when you actually have to, you know, when you're actually there and it's there all of the time, it very quickly becomes normal and it very quickly becomes boring. And I think you can see how he's been sucked into that same idea, this romantic idea of, you know, the hotel from 1648 or whatever it is with the wooden beams on the west coast of Ireland, and it all sounds very romantic. But when you actually get there, then you lose the romantic side, and then you get the, you know, the reality of it. So, you know, the building with the beams is actually like really old, and the weather isn't, it's okay, you know, if you're passing through or you're on holiday, or, you know, this is one brisk afternoon, you go, oh, wasn't that mad the way the weather was like crazy. But when you live it day in, like day out, it's never the same. And it reminds me a little bit, have you ever had that conversation with like Mrs. Trev or someone, Trev, where like years ago you might have thought, you know, should we like move to Australia or something like that? Or should we like move to another country because like the weather's better or whatever? But then when you step back from it, you go, well, it's good if you go there on holiday, but once I'm there, I'm still going to have to get a job, still going to have to work, still going to have to take the kids to school, still going to have to go shopping. It'll just be in a hotter place and I'll probably be more miserable. So it's like, you know, it's like that idea, isn't it? That like something's good fleetingly, but when you're actually stuck there, and you very much get the sense that you're stuck, doesn't it? You know, in this fjord, this like narrow inlet, is that it's just never the same. The reality is never the same as what you hope for, and therefore you get into this sort of spiral of disappointment which he seems to have got himself in his life.
And yet it is this spiral which leads to this place, which leads to the despair, which leads to the anxiety and the endless questioning of who he is and what he's doing with his life. And something we can all relate to, like I said, that idea of 40 kind of being a turning point as well in your life. And one of those years when you ask yourself questions. It's interesting, actually, Neil, when I was in my 20s, before that, I remember as a teenager talking to a pal of mine about, you know, he was consoling himself via me, saying, don't worry about it, Trev. When we're 30, we'll be the kind of lads that all the girls will want to be with. And I was like, dude, first of all, don't include me in this. Second of all, why are you talking about 30? But my point is, people used to look at, you used to look at 30 when you were in your late teens and 20s as that'll be the age at which I'll have done X, Y, or Z. And you had a kind of a hit list or a bucket list or whatever the hell it is. Mm. I think that's very much changed as we've all sort of remained children longer to 40, for sure. I think 40 is that age now where you assess your life. And an awful lot of us may, well, you know, I think, you know, I'm atypical in that, you know, I would have been a younger dad. So I'd sort of had more experiences like that, the traditional stuff under my belt by the age of 40. But wow, can I relate to the idea of it being a mentally sort of tumultuous time. And what's really interesting is that Barry says, this is a quote from him. He says, this is a story about turning 40, which I was about to do a few weeks later, and realizing that you come to a time in your life when the power of your will and all that striving towards self-determination are only worth so much. And really, now it's all about acceptance, accepting everything that's put in your path, everything glorious and everything catastrophic. And what a release this can be. So to go full circle back to the point I was making on the back of what you said, despite all this stuff, despite all this daily angst and disillusionment, it is that very place and that environment that brings him to this moment of epiphany at the end, where he has that thing that we can all relate to, that moment of artistic insight. And he feels this flood of release where he goes, I know the words are going to come, you know, the whatever he calls it, the long silence that he's in as a poet is about to end. And he's enthused immensely by this. And, you know, of course, the key phrase is the phrase that's at the very end of the story, the phrase that tells you that he has been passing through a stage and is about to leave it because the gloom of youth had at last lifted. And I suppose I want to just focus on that for a minute with you. What do you think has happened to him there? Like, is it as self-evident as it all appeared to be about to disappear? Everything appeared to be about to be taken away from him. He couldn't think of a more despondent situation for him to be in, failing as a host, failing as a landlord, failing as a writer, failing as a person, sexually frustrated beyond the beyonds. And then this moment of cordiality and camaraderie and feeling accepted by a group of people. Is it that simple, do you think, Neil?
I think it's absolutely the part about being accepted, because it's one of those things you don't notice it maybe if you've just listened to it once or twice or what have you. But now I've like listened to it and read it a few times, there is a clear tipping point in it. And the clear tipping point where it becomes quite a morose story and he's like really angry and what have you, and quite aggressive. And where it takes a turn where all of a sudden his mood becomes a little bit better is the point at which he offers them all free drinks. So as the hotel, as it becomes clear that they're all going to be trapped in this hotel together, and at that point he then offers everyone like free drinks. From that point onwards, I think what happens then is you have that spirit of camaraderie, and because what you've got for the first time then is for the first time he is then having a shared experience with these people. Beforehand, he's being the outsider who thinks he's better and superior than everyone else. A lot of these people he finds very annoying. And it's because he hasn't really got anything in common with them. He's not interested in talking about how long it takes to get from A to B. He hasn't lived in that area for, you know, X amount of years and knows all of the stories and what have you. But from the point at which they're all trapped in that hotel together, they're having that then shared experience. And from that point onwards, that's where you get that sort of sense of camaraderie. And his mood actually, his mood takes a real significant turn at that point. And what you've also got then as well is he actually becomes useful. You know, he takes away, it's like a leadership sort of role almost. He goes from the man who's being ignored through the first half of the story, from the man who gives everyone drinks, then he takes them up the stairs to safety because the bottom part of the hotel is flooding. And then he puts the disco lights on. And then he puts the music and turns off the bright lights and like tries to like make a better mood. And he's doing something and he's improving the lives of these people and he's helping them and they're all responding to it well and what have you. And I think that he hasn't planned that at all. What's really good is there's no real like inner dialogue about why he does any of this. He just does it spontaneously. He goes to actually like a real proper host and sort of thinking on his feet and plowing everyone with drinks and discos and whatever to keep their minds off it. And he becomes much more sort of important sort of in their lives and what have you. And the key thing is he hasn't planned that. This has just happened. You know, this is just the way the night has evolved. And it turns out that the night evolves in a way that's really good and everyone's really happy, other than that face, the fella getting his neck bitten and the blood spurting everywhere and what have you. But everyone ends up like really happy and he's a major part of that. And I think that's where the acceptance comes from. It's like, I never thought this out. I never planned this. This has just happened because I've let just things happen and I've acted instinctively. And as a result, for the first time in the 8 months that he's been here, he's been accepted by them. And I think it's about being accepted by them and then him accepting that. You know, sometimes you don't need to just plan and what have you. You just roll with it and see what happens and trust that things will just turn out okay.
It's the moment which sort of kicks off his understanding that he must adopt acceptance is the moment in which he is accepted. And in that way, it's so relatable on a human level. And you talked, you know, I loved where, as you say, they're in this ridiculous scenario where it's very, very dangerous. And he's at the height of his powers. He's in this new character, this absolutely mine host, which he always wanted to be. And towards the very end of the story, he's out on the dance floor himself having a bit of a jig. And he goes, you know, are you happy, lads? Everyone enjoying themselves. You know, as you say, almost taking on the role of head G-up artist and keeping everyone's spirits up.
There's a really cool description in it, which, I mean, we've all done this as well. So, you know, he's had a few drinks, he's happy, and he's there in the middle of the dance floor and he's swaying back and forward, but he's got his eyes closed, but the light's still sort of shining through, like on his eyelids, and he's just sort of like listening to the music and thinking of stuff. And it's just like, we've all had that moment, haven't we? You know, where like, yeah, you're hammered and you're on a dance floor and you're just having a great night and you got your eyes closed and you're in your own head and you're like, ah, this is the fucking best, man. Like, you know what I mean? And he's just having that moment in like, and not for one second did he like ever dream that he would have that moment. So it's quite surreal, but it's like really good.
And so Kevin Barry as well. So the fact that you focus in on that one, like what I remember about, I can't quote it specifically, but what I remember about is how the insides of his eyelids are like these pinky screens, yeah. And he's remembering his old family pets or something. You're like, holy shit, that is incredible. And you know what, as well, I just, as you were talking, I was just thinking there, what sums up what you had been talking about previously about how the difficulty of the scenario, the horror of the scenario, was actually kind of conversely making him more and more confident in himself. There's a moment where you actually see that. It's such brilliant writing. I wanted to focus on it. Janie McAllister has just passed out cold on the floor after seeing that the gull, the black-back gull, is prizing his partner's head off, right, and flailing it about. And so there's a line where he says, there was no getting away from the fact that we were being sucked into the deeps of an emergency. And the next line is, I was getting happy notions, right? So he's found this whole thing energizing. And he's found it that the extremity of it has given him some sort of focus. And before we lose focus, there's so many things we want to talk about. I'm sure people want to hear a little bit of chat about the characters. You talked about them. It's quite the rogues gallery that we meet right from the start. It's hard, isn't it? And I'm going to tee you up to do this. It's hard to think of a better introductory couple of lines for any character in literature ever than John Murphy, the alcoholic funeral director. I mean, I love that guy. Talk to me a bit about him and about that, like I say, assorted rogues gallery that we meet, and why you think it is that, if you do, that they are sort of just enjoyably ordinary characters that we've all sort of experienced the equivalent of.
Yeah, well, those characters are akin to what I was talking about earlier, where when you're briefly in the presence of these characters, they're hilarious, they're really funny, but imagine being with them night after night, hearing them the same thing.
Yes.
It would quickly tire. So us, like, sort of fleeting through this pub on this like night that it gets flooded, these characters are really funny. But when you step back and take like the reality of it, John, he's got a line. I was literally howling out loud at this one, because it just makes no sense as well. And it's such a old man, masculine type line that he's got loads of bravado, loads of confidence, but when you step back from it a second, it makes absolutely no sense and it isn't any achievement at all. Where he's like a grave digger or whatever, a funeral director, and he goes, I'll bury anything that fucking moves. He said, like he's got a choice to do anything but bury the things that die in front of him. And but he's like really proud of it. He's like, he's made burying dead people into like some sort of art form, where like no matter what the thing is that it dies, he will be able to bury it in a way that no other person would be able to bury the fella who died down the road or the dog or whatever. And I don't know why, but it was just that really I've come across it loads. It's definitely a man thing, and it's definitely an old man thing. And I'm sure if we haven't already turned out like this, Trev, we might one day, where people talk really proudly about really mundane, understated stuff, but we just say it with so much confidence that, like, you know, is the whole they like identify their whole self by it, and like so it gives them like immense proud. And I just think it's the sheer preposterousness of like what he actually says. It's just I was laughing my head off at that bit. I love it so much.
I have heard someone discuss this on a different show a while ago. And the thing that stuck out to me was the person in question who was talking about it seemed to have, despite herself, a kind of a snooty attitude about these characters, and was kind of at pains to point out that they were kind of horrible. And I think that's self-evident. And I don't think you get any prizes for that. I mean, the lads say horrible things. The women say horrible things. They express prejudice. They express all sorts of phobias. But, you know, there comes a time, I think, when you're reading a story and you have to understand that what it is that the author's trying to do. And with John, when he says he'll bury anything that fucking moves, whether it's bastards, suicides, tinkers, I couldn't give a fucking monkeys. I think what you're getting there is a fella who's actually, I think you're dead right. I think it's masculine bravado. I think he's saying, you know, some other lads might have quibbled about burying fellas, you know, who have taken their own lives or who are from the traveling community, but not me. I'll bury them all. And again, it's that kind of, as you say, inane bravado. I mean, fair play, you know, you're doing your job. But it's not just that. The prejudice and the characters that express this prejudice, we can't help but like them. Even the inane warbler who's going on about how many miles it might be from X to Y, if the road is good enough, and crying about the minister who sorted out the neighbouring county with a great road, and of course that means that they can drive fast from X to Y. What about the couple that you mentioned earlier on? I mean, what a couple they are. Both of them express dark prejudice at one point or another. Mick and Vivian, because they both introduce, Mick talks initially about, you know, coming from the restaurant, there's immediately a slur in what he's saying. And then we have this display of them sort of, him particularly, acting like this oversexed and Queeving talks about, you know, how he thinks
paganistic.
Paganistic, and how he's never experienced this level of ribaldry before anywhere. Ribaldry, what a word that is. But you know, Mick singing Alicia Keys and Vivian grinding up backwards into him with her enormous haunches. I mean, how can you not look at least askance at that with a semi-affectionate eye, even though they're saying awful things? She talks at one stage about the EU, and we went on our knee to them, and now all these guys are over here taking our jobs. Mick talks about, with sort of murderous tones or murderous look in his eye, about how the lads up north are after our horses now, the bastards. And you know, it's just this lovely small town mentality, and yet you see the humanity, and never more so in that little incident that you spoke about, which is prefigured by what happens with the gull and its partner. And then later on, you've got these this incredibly physically affectionate couple who talk about it out loud and act it out in front of everybody, demonstrably doing something that is so shocking. When she takes a lump out of his neck, it's so shocking. And yet it fits right into this bloody place. And of course, Queeveen's reaction is just to pour more drinks and, you know, everybody gets on with it. And later on, there's a little sort of sideways mention about how they're trying to make it up in a banquet booth with your man holding a load of napkins to his neck and they're trying to save their marriage. There's a madness to this story.
But do you know why it fits though? I think it's because there is that like thread that goes all the way through this of violence and sort of aggression in the language. Doesn't matter what he's talking about. So there's a great phrase in the first paragraph where it talks like the rain coming down like a handful of angry nails being thrown down. I thought it was like a real like visceral sort of metaphor that really sort of gives you the idea of like, you know, when weather can be like really, really like violent. And then you've got that aggression, you know, in like the actual conversations themselves. So there's a bit where it's Bill, you know, he's banging on about how long it takes to get from one place to another. And at first the narrator says, I don't know. And then he says it again. And then he just says, I really don't fucking well know, Bill. And you can see him sort of like losing his like rag a little bit to the point where he's the barman and he's, you know, he's swearing at his clientele because he's like sort of, he's at that point. And then you got the bit with the, you know, like the birds, like obviously like ripping the head off the other one. And so by the time you get to that end bit, even if you haven't, other than the sort of the bird scene, does that just be in this just rippling and sort of throbbing along all the way through it from that very first paragraph, is this idea of like violence and aggression and just being quite an extreme place. So when that does happen at the end, it's like, yeah, of course you did that, because you know they're off their heads.
I would love to just echo something that you said earlier on about a second and a third experiencing of this story, whether you read it, and on the website we'll start to post links to actual places you can go and read the story if you prefer to, or whether you want to listen to the recording of the story a couple of times. I say it every time, but you don't get a feel for something unless you've listened to it a couple of times. I mean, I always do that when I'm listening to stuff, especially stories. On the second and third listen, and I think this is a great indicator of really good writing, you don't notice what's happening until you've listened to it a couple of times. Like, I think if you're kind of primed to pick up on little signifiers, like yourself and myself would be, because that's just how we think and what we're looking for, especially if you're doing it with a view to doing a show like this. But even with that in mind, you miss half the stuff. For example, there's a tremendous thing that runs all the way through it. You talked earlier on about how the weather, the rain was described as being like a handful of nails that were flung hard and fast by a seriously riled sky god. The weather is very much a character in that sort of, you know, almost traditional pathetic fallacy kind of way, but it's imbued with so much more drama because it's Kevin Barry. The skies are schizophrenic, or the skies are disgracefully grey. I mean, what a phrase that is.
Yeah.
Disgracefully grey. You know, the rain is hysterical, or as you said, like it's like nails being fired by a sky god. And I think, to me, what he does with, when he's using the weather and the atmospheric conditions as almost like a character, they're kind of reflections of Queeveen's own paranoia and excited state of mind, and I don't mean that in a positive way.
Yeah, definitely. And it's interesting that you say about the disgracefully grey part of it, because I was trying to think to myself, why is that so good? Because if you think about it, it's not particularly clever, is it? You know, disgracefully grey, but it really, really captures the imagination like massively. And I think this is what I was saying about it earlier about, it reminded me a little bit of, like, you know, the colloquialisms of, like, you know, like you've been friends or family and people just say slightly off the cuff things, like that you don't, and like only really they would say it. And I think you really get a sense of this fella's character straight away by the fact that he says like disgracefully grey. There's just, it's not a normal way to sort of describe grey skies, it's a little bit different. So it shows how he's like a little bit off kilter right from the start, and it immediately makes you interested in his character and his views, all of which are slightly off where you would expect them to be in this story. And I think as it goes through, he sort of surprises you again and again and again with the different things that he says, and that's there right from the start.
Yeah, I think you're spot on there. That's a really nice way of looking at it, that it's actually not just a reflection of, you know, what I was saying, which is more of an academic, detached way of looking at it, that it's the weather as a reflection of his delusional paranoia, but actually that it actually is also the language, the choice of words, the choice of adjectives tells you something about him as an individual, which you can then infer, and I think you're sort of subconsciously doing it anyway because of the fact that you know that it's his word and his turns of phrase.
Can I give you an example, Trev?
Oh, please do, man. Because, listen, if just so people know, I could spend another 45 minutes to 60 minutes just quoting lines at you. And I'm actually purposely restraining myself from doing it because we could just exchange lines here all night. This is such, I need this on the record. This is such a beautifully written story that I went out and I bought the collection. Well, I'd already had the collection it comes from, which is Dark Lies the Island. That was published, I think, 2013, around here by Vintage. I went out and bought There Are Little Kingdoms, which is an older collection of short stories by Kevin Barry. And I went out and bought Night Boat to Tangier. I've read them all, and I couldn't be more of a fan of this guy because of that thing. And I want you to give us a couple of examples now, feel free, of what an incredible writer. What an artist when it comes to coining a phrase this guy is.
Yeah, I mean, I can give examples from this story, but my example is not from this story. But what I wanted to do is just try and articulate the point that I don't think I made particularly well, in terms of when you hear a person who isn't necessarily an academic come up with a really good phrase, and you know it comes absolutely natural to them, but you've never heard anyone else say it. And I was just trying to think as I was talking about it, like examples of things I've heard people say, like, you know, like often in pubs and what have you. And I remember years ago, he was like a mate of a mate, I can't even remember his name, and he was talking about like another person, he was like really boring, and he just came out, he went, I'll tell you what, this fella, he could bore a fox off a chicken. And it's like, and that's what this fella reminds me of. It's like just like these like really like outlandish sort of like phrases and comments that are absolutely spot on. And when I hear this and read it, you really get a sense of like the character saying it rather than the writer behind the character sort of trying to show off with a little thing. It feels 100% natural to how this person would talk. And I know disgracefully grey skies, I've gone back to that again, but that's what I mean, just like that, where like one person would come up with that and then no one else ever would, and that's like his phrase. Sorry, I was just trying to articulate that point a little bit better with that I mentioned earlier with an example. That's done it.
You absolutely have. I think that's brilliant, and I think that's why people always like your contributions, because you do make a point of nailing it down. And one of the things that came to my mind because of my own sort of reading history was because just to link into your idea of turns of phrase, what Barry is tremendous at, from the reading I've done around him and of him since, is dialogue. I think that might be his incredible strength. And as he's looking around him at these guys with their turns of phrase, his initial impulse, Quivine, is to have this writerly sort of inclination to get a notebook and make a note of phrases like thrown down and stuff like that. And then pretty soon, in quick, short order, he just gets totally disillusioned with these maudlin bastards and their various things. It's fantastic. But what it reminded me of is another dude who went traveling to the wild climes of the West, John Millington Synge, who people will have heard of, Playboy of the Western World, maybe Riders to the Sea. Another great Irish, in inverted commas, writer. And when I think he was preparing himself for a play like like Playboy of the Western World, which people always talk about as having very authentic dialogue. I would take massive issue with that, but it certainly does have expressions which are rooted in the local and in the original Gaelic and stuff like that. And Singh was lodging above a sort of a guest house stroke bar stroke catch-all kind of a gaff, and there was a little gap in the floor, and he used to listen down through the gap and make notes of the local turns of phrase. And Singh actually at one point, this is a line that'll never leave me because I remember coming across it when I was trying to write an essay on the guy in college, and he said, in a good play, every speech should be as fully flavored as a nut or an apple. And I think that's him basically saying, you know, it should have the richness of the local idiom. And you can't but say that this story and this writer is particularly gifted when it comes to that stuff. And, you know, it goes from the crude to the ribald, to use the word, to the more sort of absolutely otherworldly expressions that we've mentioned already. I want to talk just briefly about the animals in passing, and then I have a little bit that I want to just chat about in terms of the idea of the setting and the contemporary setting and what you think about the people in the pub itself. The idea, I suppose, maybe of the pub as a leveler when it comes to class and things like that. But just briefly first, let me pop something at you that occurred to me, because this is on third, fourth reading, was I noticed and started to put it together that the animal characters in this story have a tremendous impact on it in terms of sort of framing moments and setting scenes. They add to the absurdity, the comic value, the horror, the darkness, the unsettling nature of it. Like, they're a glorious source of atmosphere. You've got stoats, minks, the otters. The otter who's you know, described as sort of, you know, casually, languidly as a surfer enjoying himself with the soup, carrot and coriander soup. The dogs with their howling, which are thoroughly unsettling. The gulls, the incident we've already spoken about. And probably the favourite moment for most people, they'll remember it, is the one-off where he sort of glances out at the scene outside and he sees the seven sheep in a rowing boat. And it, you know, on one hand, I winced a little bit and thought, oh my God, that's quite Father Ted, and that's what people will lean into. And the other hand, I thought, yeah, well, it's funny because it's real. I spend a lot of time in the west of Ireland, and these are the things that happen. People say, get those sheep into a boat and get them down to the next field. That's what would happen. People make priorities and decisions like that, and things like that would happen. And yes, it's comical, but it's so real. And the animals have that really massive impact in terms of, like I said, the atmosphere creation in the story, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And what's really good about talking to you about it as well, I mean, we both said now that we've listened to this listened and or read to this on like several occasions. And earlier on, you were like, oh, what about the animals? I was like, not for one minute that I picked up on the animals, because I'm like, you know, I'm too busy looking at this thing over there or this thing over there or this thing over there. Now, when you list it like that, then obviously, yeah, these animals play like a massive part, so even though thematically and symbolically, and also just, you know, creating you know, a realistic scene and also creating the comedy in it. But I think that's how sort of deep and how good this story is that, like I said, we listen to this with a view of thinking, oh, what would be interesting to talk about or what can we spot? And I still never, the whole animal thing never really even registered with me. So no, that's why I'm glad we have these chats, because I'm now thinking, going, oh yeah, I have to listen to that again and sort of see what else is going there, definitely.
Yeah, keep an eye on it the next time around. And if you're listening to us, having listened to the story, go back, listen to the story again. Seriously, it'll give you a chuckle. It'll give you some insight. We could go on, but I just want to finish with one simple idea, and that's the idea of the people themselves and how we're supposed to take them. And I just want, I think for someone who's not from this country necessarily, they might not necessarily have gotten this particular little subtle thing in it. We don't really do class here in Ireland, not the way you guys do in the UK. We're not really good at class. And I like that about Irish society in a way.
Yeah.
And you know, you're not made aware of what class you are. I grew up, you know, not well off. We were, you know, I'm not going to say like you were walking to school in our bare feet, but we were somewhere between poor and not well off. And I grew
Trev
up,
class. You were Trev class.
We were very much Downey class, and that's how it was. And you accepted it. One of my pals, his dad collected them in the primary school playing ground. In a helicopter on a Friday, and he pissed off for the weekend. So we were all pals in this little rural area of Ireland. His dad was something to do with oil, in inverted commas, and my dad was a guy who had been in the army and was a fitter.
I love that, Trev. 6-year-old Trev walking 20 miles with plastic bags on his feet for shoes, watching the lad get off in his helicopter.
He's just getting off on this helicopter. But what I suppose this is a long-winded way of me getting to the point, which is in the pub, you have, like I said earlier on, the prejudice is coming out. And what I love about it is that this is totally new Ireland. This is post-Celtic Tiger Ireland. This is the Ireland where we were on the bones of our arse. We were like those poets that he describes with the scrawny arses sitting on the rocks. We were like that. That's what we were here. Then something happened around about 1990, and it coincided with Italia 90 and the Euros and all, in 88, and the Celtic Tiger economy starting to boom. We suddenly got notions about ourselves in this country, and suddenly everyone had two houses. And then, of course, in the way of all things, the arse fell out of it. But we still have that residual thing. We would never now consider drinking anything other than a specific type of coffee. When I was growing up, it was black coffee and white coffee. But now you've got varieties of coffee, and everyone's clued in on little cultural things that we weren't before. We all have notions about ourselves. And in this pub, they do too. And what I love about it is how they zero in on the Belarusians, and they have sort of quietly prejudiced feelings about them because they're encroaching on their territory in the same way as my ancestors did when they went to America and England and Liverpool and every other country in the world, Australia, and made their way and founded their little communities there. It is an interesting aspect of it, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's where the couple of references to Thackeray have probably got a little bit more
lovely. Finish us with that. Yeah, finish us with that.
Than before, because so I assume when he says Thackeray, I assume he's talking about William Makepeace saying Thackeray. So for anyone who doesn't know, William Makepeace Thackeray was a 19th century Victorian writer. Now, I'm not going to say I've read everything by William Makepeace Thackeray, but I have read Vanity Fair, and Vanity Fair is by far his most famous novel. Although it was actually like a lot of those Victorian novels, it was a serialization, and essentially what they do is they put it all together at the end and then they make a novel out of it. Now, interestingly, Vanity Fair is about class and is about very much, you know, the middle classes and the upper middle classes, and you know, it follows the story of, I think it's Becky Sharp, essentially rising through the classes and what have you. But what it does do, and I think where the links are here, is that it's got a multitude. It's really thick. I think it's like 800 pages or something like that. But it's got loads of characters in. It's a bit like Dickens in that, where it's just character after character after character, and they're all sort of painted very vividly, and they're not caricatures, but they're all larger than life, and it's very much considered Vanity Fair like a snapshot of society, a snapshot of that person in society, a snapshot of that person, loads and loads of snapshots of different people and different larger than life characters in society. It's also satirical, it's funny. It's supposed to be funny. And also, and finally on that, is it's actually got an alternative name, Vanity Fair. Now, I don't know exactly what it is, but it's something along the lines of a story with no heroes. And it was considered sort of like at the time, you know, with the Victorian novel to be sort of the first domestic Victorian novel where there's no hero in it. It's very anti-hero. And all of the characters in it are very much flawed and not perfect. And it's trying to be a representation of, you know, what society is like, where, like, you know, everyone is flawed and it isn't full of heroes and there isn't necessarily goodies and baddies and what have you. So if you take away the class part of it, but then think about all of those other aspects and then transpose that onto this story and what this story is, well, it's exactly the same. It's these larger than life characters. It's a snapshot of society within this hotel. You know, it's funny, it's got the satire in it, and also all of these people are flawed as well. There's no heroes in this, and so I do think that sort of a couple of references to Thackeray in it, you know, that being someone that the narrator at least likes, probably means the author likes him as well. And I think there is a link there between the way this story is set up and the way in which Vanity Fair is set up as well.
Oh man, I love that. You've tied a lovely bow on the end of this, which is tremendous, and I appreciate that immensely. As ever, I can rely on you to do that. And I want to recommend that people do go out. Like I say, the collection that's from is Dark Lies the Island. You can also get it, as Neil said earlier on, it's one of the ones that's actually available to read on the New Yorker for free. There Are Little Kingdoms is the other collection, which is wonderful. And Night Boat to Tangier, his 2019 novel, I'd recommend as well. I have yet to read City of Bohan, and there are a couple of other bits and pieces. I think he's got three short story collections, three novels. Look into Kevin Barry, you will not regret it. I want to just talk briefly about two things because we've gone long here. The first is that we will be back almost as quickly as you can imagine with our next story, which is going to be a massive contrast. It's going to bring us back to the idea of The Bet by Anton Chekhov, where you've got a moral conundrum. It's a story called Those Who Walk Away from Omelas. That's by Ursula K. Le Guin. Loads of angles there, and a bit more of a research heavy story in that one, and more of a pointed discussion in terms of very specific things that we'll be talking about. Probably less free flowing and rambling than this one, but equally, I hope, engaging. It's a very different type of story, and I think it'll push a lot of nice back of your brain buttons for everybody. Like I say, a moral conundrum is one we can all get our teeth into. So that will be next up from the Great Stories. And can I please ask you to go and have a look at greatstoriespod.com at the end of the next podcast? What I want to do is, with their permission, just give a shout out to those people who have become sustaining members. I appreciate you people immensely. You're tremendous folks. I gave a shout out to the first three guys who had signed up before I'd even asked at the end of the last show, and that kind of show of faith is deeply appreciated. And I want to do that for everybody who signs up as a supporting member, if they're okay with it. In the meantime, Neb has been good enough to work with me, and we've managed to get a donate button on the front page, which basically says, consider supporting the show with a one-off donation. And that means, say you listen to this one today and you go, yeah, I really enjoyed that. I'm not really in a situation where I can sign up for a subscription. I'll do a one-off donation. That there now is an option. I've seen one or two people have taken that up as well. This is the first time I'm sort of publicizing it. And obviously we have tiny amounts of traffic going to the website at the moment. This is something we want to build. Will you please help us, if nothing else, with the spreading of the word about this podcast? From minute one, you've heard me say that I believe that this is something that can have real significance and cultural value for not just the small group that are listening to it, but a bigger group. I know it's nice to be cool and to have our own small little group, and nobody likes too big of a group to get going. But I think this is something we can all share. And I would love it to be something that would be sustaining for myself and Neil, that we could be throwing this kind of stuff at you on a regular basis. There will always be, like I say, free content coming from us, because that's just the way it's going to be. I believe in that value for value thing. But the way that you can show support for what you're hearing, what you're getting, is by signing up for a subscription, which would be deeply appreciated, or a one-off donation by clicking that donate button. Both of them are fairly straightforward things, or a simple PayPal interaction. That's the ugly commercial side of it. Out of the way, I said I keep it short. I will continue to do that. You're not going to be getting bombarded by ads ever from us. I don't believe in it. I think it's kind of crass. I have no feelings of guilt about asking you for support, because this is something that we want to make a lasting thing. And that's the only way this works. I think we have to be honest and say that for the most part, the days of the Wild West and the internet are sort of passing. Free is a thing of the past to a certain extent, and people are going to be more and more discerning about how they sort of put together and curate the things that they like and they like to support. I know, for example, I'm cutting loose all my television, big television company subscriptions, and I'm going to go to the things that I want to watch. So I can assume people will be putting similar things in mind. I know I try to support independent media in that way as well. So if you can find it in your capacity to do that, it'd be greatly appreciated. Neil and I will be back to talk to you about Those Who Walk Away from Mamalas by Ursula K. Le Guin next time out. And it just remains for me to say, as ever, thanks very much, Neil.
Thanks, mate.